So whose guns are they? How should I know? As far as I can tell, they're the property of the United States Marine Corps, just like it says on the box. Quit asking questions and let's go. They re-entered the hatch and began to climb. He felt the temperature rise with every step of their ascent. 10 meters up, they reached a small platform with a ladder. In the ceiling over their heads was another hatch. Alicia rested the lantern on the platform, reached overhead on tiptoes, and began to turn the wheel. They were both sweating hard. The air felt almost too thick to breathe. It's stuck. He reached up to help her. With a rusty squeal, the mechanism released. 2 turns, 3. The hatch dropped open on its hinges. Cool night air tumbled through the opening like a current of water, smelling of desert, of dry juniper and mesquite. Above, Peter could see only blackness. "Me first," Alicia said. "I'll call you up." He heard her footsteps moving away from the opening. He listened for more, but heard nothing. They were up on the roof somewhere, no lights to protect them. He counted to 20, 30. Should he follow her? Then Alicia's face appeared above him, floating over the open hatch. "Leave the lantern there. It's all clear. Come on." He ascended the ladder and found himself in a small crawl space, with pipes and valves and more crates stacked along the walls. He paused, letting his eyes adjust. He was facing an open door. He took a deep breath and stepped forward. He stepped into the stars. It hit him in the lungs first, shoving the breath from his chest. A feeling of pure physical panic, as if he'd stepped onto nothing, onto the night sky itself. His knees bent beneath him, his free hands scrabbled at the air, searching for something to hold on to give himself a feeling of form and weight, the working dimensions of the world around him. The sky above was a vault of blackness, and everywhere, the stars. "Peter, breathe," Alicia said. She was standing beside him. He realized that her hand was resting on his shoulder. In the dark, Alicia's voice seemed to come from very close and far away at once. He did as she said, letting deep gulps of night air fill his chest. Bit by bit, his eyes adjusted. Now he could make out the edge of the roof, spilling into nothingness. They were in the southwest corner, he realized, near the exhaust port. "So what do you think?" For a long, quiet moment, he let his eyes roam the sky. The longer he looked, the more stars appeared to him, pushing through the blackness. These were the stars his father had spoken of, the stars his father had seen on the long rides. "Does Theo know?" Alicia laughed. "Does Theo know what?" "The hatch? The guns?" Peter shrugged helplessly. "All of it." "I never showed him, if that's what you mean. I'm guessing Xander does, since he knows every inch of this place. But he's never said a word to me about it." His eyes searched out her face. She seemed different somehow in the dark. The same Alicia he had always known, but also someone new. He understood what she had done. She'd saved it for him. "Thanks." "Don't go thinking this means we're friends or anything. If Arlo had woken up first, it'd be him standing here." That wasn't true, and he knew it. "Even so," he said. She led him to the edge of the roof. They were facing north across the valley. Not a breath of wind was blowing. On the far side, the shape of the mountains was etched into the sky as a dark bulk pushed up against a shimmering rim of stars. They took positions, lying side by side with their bellies pressed against the concrete, still warm with the heat of the day. "Here," Alicia said, reaching into her pouch. "You'll want one of these." A night scope. She showed him how to fix it to the top of the rifle and adjust the gain. Peter placed his eye to the viewfinder and saw a landscape of shrubs and rocks, all washed in a pale green light with a pair of hatched crosshairs bisecting his view. At the bottom of the scope he saw a readout. 212 meters. The numbers rose and fell as he swept the rifle back and forth. Amazing. You think they're still alive? Alicia took a moment to answer. I don't know. Probably not. It can't hurt to wait, though. She paused again. There wasn't much else to say on the subject. Then, you think I was too hard on Mouse today? The question surprised him. As long as he'd known her, Alicia had never been one to second-guess herself. Not the way it worked out. You did the right thing. She's a loss. You can't say she isn't. It doesn't matter. You said it yourself. Mouse knows the rules as well as anyone. I'd rather keep her than Galen. She groaned. Flyers. That guy. What the hell could she see in him? Peter lifted his face from the scope. The sky was so thick with stars it was as if he could reach out and brush them with his hand. He'd never seen anything so beautiful in his life. It made him think of the oceans, the names in the book like the words of a song. Atlantic, Pacific, Indian, Arctic. And about his father, standing on the edge of the sea. Maybe the stars were what Auntie meant when she spoke of God. The old God, from the time before. The God of heavens who watched the world. Do you ever, Alicia began, I don't know, think about it? Peter shifted to face her. Her eye was still pressed to her scope. Think about what? Alicia gave a nervous laugh, a sound he'd never heard her make. You're going to make me say it? Pairing, Peter. Having littles. He had. Of course he had. Almost everybody paired by the time they were 20. But standing the watch made it hard. Up all night, sleeping most of the day, or else walking around in a daze of exhaustion. But when Peter faced the question squarely, he knew that wasn't the only reason. Something about the idea simply did not seem possible. It applied to others, but not to him. There had been girls for him, and then a few he would have described as women. Each had occupied a few months' time, working him up into such a state that they were briefly most of what he thought about. But in the end he had always drifted away, or found himself inexplicably directing them toward someone he thought of as more suitable. Not really, no. What about Sarah? A feeling of defensiveness rose up inside him. What about her? Come on, Peter, Alicia said, and he heard the exasperation in her voice. I know she wants to pair with you. It's no secret. She's first, too. It would be a good match. Everyone thinks so. What does that have to do with anything? I'm just saying. It's obvious. Well, it isn't obvious to me. He paused. They had never spoken like this before. Look, I like Sarah fine. I'm just not certain I want to pair with her. But you do want to. Pair, I mean. Someday, maybe. Leash, why are you asking this? He turned his face toward her again. She was looking through her scope across the valley, slowly sweeping the horizon line with her rifle. Leash? Hold on. Something's moving. He rolled back into position. Where? Alicia quickly lifted the barrel of her rifle, pointing. 2 o'clock. He pressed his eye to the scope. A solitary figure darting from one stand of scrub to another, 100 meters past the fence line. Human. It's High Top, Alicia said. How do you know? Too small to be Xander. Nobody else out there. He's alone? I can't tell, Alicia said. Wait. No. 10 degrees right. Peter looked. A flash of green in the scope, skipping like a stone over the desert floor. Then he saw a second and a third, 200 meters in closing. Not closing. Circling. What are they doing? Why don't they just take him? I don't know. Then they heard it. Hey! The voice was Caleb's, high and wild and full of fear. He was up and running toward the fence, waving his arms.
"Open the gate! Open the gate!"
"Flyers!" Alicia rolled to her feet. "Come on!" They raced back to the crawlspace. Alicia quickly opened one of the containers stacked by the hatch. She withdrew a pistol of some kind, short, with a fat, snub-nosed barrel. Peter had no time to ask. They ran back to the edge and Alicia pointed it up and over the turbine field and fired. The flare shot skyward, dragging a hissing tail of light. Peter instinctively knew he shouldn't look, but he couldn't stop himself. He looked anyway, his vision instantly seared by the image of the flare's white-hot center. At its apex, the flare seemed to stop, suspended in space. Then it exploded, bathing the field in light.
"We've bought him a minute," Alicia said.
"There's a ladder down the back." They slung their weapons over their shoulders. Alicia descended the ladder first, taking it like a pair of poles, her feet not even touching the rungs. As Peter scrambled down, she shot another flare, arcing it over the station toward the field. Then they ran. Caleb was standing on the far side of the metal gate. The virals had scattered back into the shadows.
"Please, let me in!"
"Shit, we don't have a key," Peter said.
Alicia shouldered her rifle and aimed it at the panel. A burst of fire and noise, a shower of sparks poured forth as the panel shot from its pole.
"Caleb, you'll have to climb over."
"I'll fry!"
"No, you won't. The current's off."
She looked at Peter.
"You think it's off?"
"How should I know?"
Alicia stepped forward and before Peter could say anything, pressed her palm to the fence. Nothing happened.
"Hurry, Caleb!"
Caleb curled his fingers between the wires and began to climb. Around them, the shadows flattened as the second flare completed its descent. Alicia withdrew a fresh flare from her waist pouch, loaded the pistol, and fired. Up and up it sailed, riding its tail of smoke, and burst above them in a shower of light.
"That's the last," she said to Peter. "We've got about 10 seconds before they figure out the current's off."
Caleb was straddling the top of the fence now.
"Caleb," she yelled, "move your ass!"
He took the last 5 meters at a drop, rolling as he landed and vaulting to his feet. His cheeks were wet from crying, smeared with dirt and snot. His feet were bare. In another few seconds, they'd be in the dark again.
"Are you hurt?" Alicia said. "Can you run?"
The boy nodded. They took off toward the station. Peter felt the virals coming before he saw them. He turned in time to see one launching toward them from the top of the fence. A blast of gunfire went off next to his ear. The creature twisted in the air and went down, skidding across the hardpan. He turned to see Alicia, her rifle shouldered, her eyes fixed on the fence. She let off 3 more shots in quick succession.
"Get him out of here!" she yelled.
He raced with Caleb to the ladder. Behind them, Alicia continued to fire, the sound of her rifle shots reaching him as muffled pops that echoed through the yard. More virals were inside the fence line now. Slinging his rifle, Peter mounted the ladder. When he reached the top, he turned to look. Alicia was backing toward the wall of the station, shooting into the shadows. When her gun went silent, she cast it aside and began to climb. Peter shouldered his rifle and aimed in the same general direction and squeezed the trigger. The barrel kicked up, his shot sailing uselessly into the dark. His whole body shook with the feel of it, its wild force.
"Watch what you're doing,"
Alicia cried, pressing her body to the ladder below him.
"And for God's sakes, aim."
"I'm trying."
There were 3 now, coming out of the shadows toward the ladder's base. Peter took a step to his right, clamping the stock hard against his shoulder.
Aim it like a cross.
He had very little chance of hitting them, but maybe he could scare them off. He squeezed the trigger and they jumped away, rolling across the yard and skittering into the dark. He'd bought a few seconds at most.
"Shut up and climb," he yelled. "I will if you stop shooting at me."
Then she was at the top. He found her hand and pulled hard, vaulting her onto the concrete surface of the roof. Caleb was waving to them from the mouth of the hatch.
"Behind you!"
As Alicia clambered down the hatch, Peter turned. A single viral was standing on the edge of the roof. Peter raised his gun and fired, but too late. The place where the creature had stood was empty.
"Forget the smokes," Alicia yelled from below.
Come on!
He dropped straight through the opening, tumbling into Caleb, who folded under him with a grunt. A sharp pain sliced his ankle as he hit the platform. The rifle clattered away. Alicia stepped over the two of them and reached up to seal the hatch. But something was pressing down on the other side. Alicia's face clenched with exertion. Her feet scrabbled at the ladder, fighting for leverage.
I can't close it!
Peter and Caleb leapt to their feet and pushed. But the force on the far side was too great. Peter had done something to his ankle when he'd fallen, but the pain was vague now, unimportant. He scanned the platform below for his rifle and found it, lying at the top of the stairs.
Let go, he said. Drop the hatch. It's the only way. Are you crazy?
But then he saw in Alicia's eyes that she understood his intentions.
Good. Do it.
She turned to Caleb, who nodded.
Ready?
One, two,
three!
They released the hatch. Peter dropped to the platform, the pain exploding in his ankle as he made impact. He lunged for the rifle and swung around, thrusting the muzzle upward through the opening. There was no time to aim, but he hoped he wouldn't have to. He didn't. The end of the barrel went straight into the viral's open mouth. The barrel speared him like an arrow, sliding past the rows of glossy teeth, coming to rest where it pressed against the bony ridge at the top of his throat. And Peter looked him in the eyes and thought, "Be still," giving the rifle one hard shove to drive it home before he shot Xander Phillips through the brain. Chapter 21. There was one great difference between the world as it was now and the world of the time before, Michael Fisher thought, and it wasn't the virals. The difference was electricity. The virals were a problem, sure. About 42.5 million problems, if the old documents in the HD shed behind the lighthouse were correct. A whole history of the epidemic in its final hours for Michael the Circuit to read. CV-1 through CV-13, National and Regional Summary of Select Surveillance Components, Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, Atlanta, Georgia. Civilian Resettlement Protocols for Urban Centers, Zones 6-1, Federal Emergency Management Agency, Washington, D.C. Efficacy of Post-Exposure Protection Against CV Familial Hemorrhagic Fever in Non-Human Primates, United States Army Medical Research Institute for Infectious Diseases, Fort Detrick, Maryland, and so on, in that vein. Some of which he understood, some of which he didn't, but all saying the same basic thing. 1 person in 10. 1 person taken up for every 9 that died. So, assuming a human population of 500 million at the time of the outbreak, the combined populations of the United States, Canada, and Mexico, and forestalling for the moment the question of the rest of the world, about which very little seemed to be known, and even assuming some kind of mortality rate for the virals themselves, say a modest 15%, that still left 42.5 million of the bloodthirsty bastards bouncing around between the Panamanian isthmus and the Bering frontier, gobbling up everything with hemoglobin in its veins and a heat signature between 36 and 38 degrees, i.e. 99.96% of the mammalian kingdom, from voles to grizzly bears. So, okay. A problem. But just give me enough current, Michael thought, and I can keep the virals out forever. The time before. He sometimes trembled just to think of it. The great buzzing, man-made electrical juiciness of it all. The millions of miles of wire, the billions of amps of current. The vast generating plants turning the bottled energy of the planet itself into the eternally affirmative question that was a single amp of current shooting down the line saying yes, yes, yes. And the machines. The wondrous, humming, glowing machines. Not just computers and Blu-rays and handhelds. They had dozens of these devices, scavenged over the years from trips down the mountain, socked away in the shed. But simple things, ordinary everyday things like hair dryers and microwaves and filament light bulbs. All wired up, plugged in, connected to the grid. Sometimes it was like the current was still out there, waiting for him. Waiting for Michael Fisher to throw the switch and turn the whole thing, human civilization itself, back on. He spent too much time alone in the lighthouse. Fair enough. Just him and Elton, which most of the time was like being alone in the social sense of things. In the let's chat about the weather and what's for chow sense of things. He didn't say he didn't. And there was lots of juice still out there, Michael knew. Diesel generators the size of whole towns. Huge LNG plants fat with gas and waiting to go. Acres of solar panels giving their unblinking gaze to the desert sun. Pocket-sized nukes humming away like atomic harmonicas, the heat in the control rods slowly building over decades until someday the whole thing would just go sailing through the floor, exploding in a shower of radioactive steam that somewhere high above, a long-forgotten satellite, powered by a tiny nuclear cell of its own, would record as the final agonies of a dying brother. Before it, too, darkened, soaring headlong to Earth in a streak of unacknowledged light. What a waste. And time was running out. Rust, corrosion, wind, rain, the nibbling teeth of mice and the acrid droppings of insects and the devouring jaws of years, the war of nature upon machines, of the planet's chaotic forces upon the works of humankind. The energy that men had pulled from the earth was being inexorably pulled back into it, sucked like water down a drain. Before long, if it hadn't happened already, not a single high-tension pole would be left standing on the earth. Mankind had built a world that would take 100 years to die, a century for the last lights to go out. The worst of it was, he'd be there when it happened. The batteries were decaying. Decaying badly. He could see it happening before his eyes, on the screen of his old battle-hardened CRT and its thrumming bars of green. The cells had been built to last how long? 30 years? 50? That they could hold any kind of charge after almost a century was a miracle. You could keep the turbines spinning forever in the breeze, but without the batteries to store and regulate the current, one windless night was all it would take. Fixing the batteries was impossible. The batteries weren't made to be fixed. They were made to be replaced. You could retrofit all the gaskets you wanted, clear away the corrosion, rewire the controllers till the herd came home. All basically busy work, because the membranes had had it. The membranes were cooked, their polymer pathways hopelessly gummed up with sulfonic acid molecules. That's what the monitor was telling him with that little bitty hiccup in the day-to-day. Short of the U.S. Army showing up with a brand new stack fresh from the factory. Hey, sorry, we forgot about you guys. The lights were going to fail. 1 year, 2 at the outside. And when that happened, it would be he, Michael the Circuit, who'd have to stand up and say, listen, everybody, I've got some not great news. Tonight's forecast? Darkness, with widespread screaming. It's been fun keeping the lights on, but I have to die now, just like all of you. The only person he'd told was Theo. Not Gabe Curtis, who was technically head of Light and Power, but had mostly checked out when he got sick, leaving Michael and Elton to run the shop. Not Sanjay or Old Chow or anyone else. Not even Sarah, his sister. Why had Michael chosen Theo to tell? They were friends. Theo was household. Sure, there had always been a touch of the gloom about him. Michael, of all people, knew this when he saw it. And it was a heavy thing to tell a man that he and everybody he knew was dead, basically. Maybe Michael was just thinking of the day when he'd have to explain the situation, hoping Theo would break the news instead, or at least back him up somehow. Yet even to Theo, who was better informed than most, the batteries were more like a permanent fixture of nature than something man-made, governed by physical laws. Like the sun and sky and walls, the batteries just were. The batteries drank up the juice from the turbines and spit it out into the lights, and if something went wrong, well, light and power would fix it. Right, Michael? Theo had said. This problem with the batteries. You can repair it. Around and around like this for some time, until Michael, in complete exasperation, had sighed and shaken his head and spelled out the situation in words of exactly one syllable. Theo, you're not hearing me. You're not hearing what I'm saying. The lights will go off. They were sitting on the porch of the small one-story frame house Michael shared with Sarah, who was off somewhere for the afternoon, riding herd or taking temperatures in the infirmary or visiting Uncle Walt to make sure he was actually eating and washing. Mooning around restlessly, in other words, the way she always did. It was late afternoon. The house stood at the edge of the short grass meadow where they turned out the horses to graze, though the dry days of summer had come on early, and the field was the color of bread crust, burned clear through to the dirt in places, forming bare spots that pillowed with dust when you walked across them. Everybody knew the house as the Fisher Place. Off, Theo repeated. The lights. Michael nodded. Off. 2 years, you say. Michael studied Theo's face, watching the information taking hold. It could be longer, but I don't think so. It could be less, too. And there's nothing you can do to fix it. No one can. Theo exhaled sharply, as if he'd just taken a punch. Okay. I get it. He shook his head. Flyers, I get it. Who else have you told? Nobody. Michael lifted his shoulders in a shrug. You're it. Theo rose and moved to the edge of the porch. For a moment, neither spoke. We'll have to move, Michael said, or else find another power source. Theo was looking away toward the field. And just how do you suggest we do that? I don't. I'm just stating it as a fact. When the batteries drop below 20%, I know, that's it. No lights, Theo said. You've made that clear. What should we do? Theo gave a hopeless laugh. How in hell should I know? I mean, should we tell people? Michael paused, searching his friend's face. So they can, you know, prepare themselves. Theo thought a moment. Then he shook his head. No. And that was all. They'd never spoken of it again. When had that been? Over a year ago. Along about the time Mouse and Galen had gotten married. The first wedding in a long, long time. It felt strange, everyone so happy, and Michael knowing what he did. People were surprised that it was Galen up there with Masami instead of Theo. Only Michael knew the reason, or could guess at it. He'd seen the look in Theo's eyes that afternoon on the porch. Something had gone out of him, and it didn't seem to Michael like the kind of thing a person could get back. There was nothing to do now but wait. Wait. And listen. Because that was the thing. The radio was forbidden. The problem, as Michael understood it, had boiled down to too many people. It was the radio that had led the walkers to the colony in the early days. Nothing the builders had ever planned on, since the colony wasn't supposed to last as long as it had. So the decision had been made that right then, in the year 17, 75 years ago, the radio should be destroyed, the antenna taken down from the mountain, its parts chopped up and scattered in the dump. At the time, it might have made sense. Michael could see how that was possible. The army knew where to find them, and there was only so much food and fuel to go around, so much room under the lights. But not now.
Not with the batteries the way they were, the lights about to fail. Blackness and screaming and dying, etc. It wasn't long after Michael's conversation with Theo, not more than a few days as he recalled, that he had happened upon the old logbook. Happened being not quite the correct word, as things turned out. It was the quiet hour just before dawn. Michael had been sitting at the panel in the lighthouse like always, minding the monitors and flipping through teacher's copy of What to Name the Baby. That's how desperate he'd become for something new to read. He'd just made it to the eyes. When for some unknown reason, restlessness or boredom or the discomforting thought that if the winds had blown a little differently, his parents might have named him Ichabod. Ichabod, the circuit? His eyes had drifted upward to the shelf above his CRT, and there it was. A notebook with a thin black spine. Standing there among the usual whatnot, tucked between a spool of solder and a stack of Elton's CDs. Billie Holiday Sings the Blues, Sticky Fingers by the Rolling Stones, Superstars Number One Party Dance Hits, a group called Yo Mama that sounded to Michael like a bunch of people yelling at each other. Not that he understood the first thing about music. Michael must have looked right at it 1,000 times, and yet he couldn't remember seeing it before. That was curious. The thought that gave him pause. A book. Something he hadn't read. He'd read everything. He rose and took it from its place on the shelf, and when he cracked the spine, the first thing he saw, inscribed in a precise hand, an engineer's hand, was a name he knew. Rex Fisher. Michael's great-great-great-grandfather. Rex Fisher, first engineer of Light and Power, First Colony, California Republic. What the hell? How had he missed this? He turned the pages, crinkled with moisture and age. It took only a moment for his mind to parse the information, to break it into its components and reassemble it into a coherent whole that told him what this slender, ink-filled volume was. Columns of numbers, with dates written in the old style, followed by the hour, and another number Michael understood to be the frequency of transmission, and then, in the spaces to the right, short notations, rarely more than a few words but heavy with suggestion, whole stories folded into them. Unmanned distress beacon, or five survivors, or military, or three en route from Prescott, Arizona. There were other place names, too. Ogden, Utah, Kerrville, Texas, Las Cruces, New Mexico, Ashland, Oregon. Hundreds of such notations, filling page after page until they simply stopped. The final entry read simply, "All transmissions ceasing by order of the household." A glow was paling the windows by the time Michael finished. He doused the lantern and rose from his chair as morning bell began to peal. Three solid rings followed by a pause of identical duration, then three more in case you didn't get the message the first time. "It's morning. You're alive." And crossed the maze-like clutter of the narrow room with its plastic bins of parts and scattered tools and dirty dishes in teetering piles. Why Elton couldn't just eat in the barracks, Michael had no idea. The man was just flat-out disgusting. Stepped to the breaker panel and powered down the lights. A wave of weary satisfaction washed through him as it always did at morning bell. One more night's work accomplished. All souls safe and sound to face another day. Let's see Alicia and her blades do that. And wasn't it true that when he'd lifted his face to see the logbook, it had been the image of Alicia in his mind that had distracted him? As it sometimes, often, did. And not just Alicia, but the specific picture of sunlight flaring her hair as she had stepped from the armory that very evening, Michael moving down the path toward her unseen. An image that was, as he considered it again, quite striking. All this despite the fact that Alicia Donadio was, in point of fact, the single most annoying woman on earth. Not that there was such a vast field of competitors. He returned to the panel and moved through the steps, flipping the cells to charge, turning on the fans and opening the vents. The meters,
which stood at 28% across the board, began to flicker and rise. He swiveled to look at Elton, who appeared to be dozing in his chair, though it was sometimes hard to tell. Waking and sleeping, Elton's eyes were always the same, two thin strips of yellow jelly peeking through slitted eyelids of perpetually tearing dampness that never quite managed to close. His pale hands were folded over the curve of his belly, the earphones, as always, clamped to the sides of his scaly head, pumping out the music he listened to all night. The Beatles, Boys Beware, Art Lundgren and his all-girl polka party orchestra. The only one that Michael sort of liked. Elton? No answer. Michael turned his voice up a notch. Elton! The old man, Elton was 50 at least, startled to life.
Flyers, Michael. What time is it?
Relax. It's morning. We're down for the night.
Elton screwed himself up in his chair, setting the hinges creaking, and drew the earphones down into the folds of his neck.
Then why you wake me up for? I was just getting to the good part.
Next to the CDs, Elton's nightly forays into imagined sexual adventure constituted his major pastime. Dreams of women, conveniently long dead, which he would recount to Michael in excruciating detail, claiming that these were actually memories of things that had happened to him in his younger days. It was all bullshit, Michael figured, since Elton hardly ever set foot outside the lighthouse, and to look at him now, with his dandruffy head and tangled beard and gray teeth clotted with the remains of a meal he had probably eaten 2 days ago, Michael didn't see how any of it was even remotely possible.
"Don't you want to hear about it?"
The old man gave his eyebrows a suggestive wag.
"It was the hay dream.
I know you like that one."
"Not now, Elton. I found something. A book."
"You woke me up because you found a book?"
Michael scooted his chair down the length of the panel and placed the log in the old man's lap. Elton ran his fingers over the cover, his sightless eyes turned upward, then drew it to his nose and gave a long sniff.
"Now I'd say that would be your great-grandfather's logbook. Thing's been floating around here for years."
He passed it back to Michael.
"Can't say I've read it myself. Find anything good in there?"
"Elton, what do you know about this?"
"Couldn't say. Things do have a way of popping up right when you need them, though."
Which was when Michael realized why he hadn't seen the book before. He hadn't seen it before because it wasn't there.
"You put it on the shelf, didn't you?" "Now, Michael, radio's forbidden. You know that."
"Elton, did you talk to Theo?"
"Theo who?"
Michael felt his irritation mount. Why couldn't the man just answer a question?
"Elton..."
The old man cut him off with a raised hand.
"Okay, don't get your gaps in a twist. No, I didn't talk to Theo. Though I'm guessing you did. I didn't talk to anyone except for you."
He paused.
"You know, you're more like your old man than you think, Michael. He wasn't a very good liar either."
Somehow Michael wasn't surprised. He slumped down into his chair. Part of him was glad.
"So how bad are they?"
Elton asked.
"Not good."
He shrugged. For some reason, he was looking at his hands.
"Number 5 is the worst. 2 and 3 a little better than the others. We've got irregular charge on 1 and 4. 28 this morning across the board. Never over 55 by first bell." Elton nodded.
"So... brownouts within the next 6 months. Total failure within 30. More or less like your father figured."
"He knew?"
"Your old man could read those batteries like a book, Michael. He could see this coming a long time ago."
So there it was. His father had known, and probably his mother too. A familiar panic rose within him. He didn't want to think about this. He didn't. Michael? He took a deep breath to calm himself. One more secret for him to carry. But he would do what he always did, pushing the information down inside himself as far as it could go. So, said Michael, how exactly do you build a radio? Radio wasn't the problem, Elton explained. It was the mountain that was the problem. The original beacon had run off an antenna that stood at the peak of the mountain. An insulated cable, 5 kilometers long, had run the length of the power trunk to connect it to the transmitter in the lighthouse. All taken down and destroyed by the one law. Without the antenna, they were hopelessly blocked to the east, and any signal they might have picked up would be overwhelmed by electromagnetic interference from the battery stack. That left 2 choices. Go to the household and ask for permission to run an antenna up the mountain, or say nothing and try to boost the signal somehow. It was, in the end, no contest. Michael couldn't ask for permission without explaining the reason, which meant telling the household about the batteries. And to tell them about the batteries was simply out of the question, because then everyone would know, and once that happened, the rest wouldn't matter. It wasn't just the batteries that Michael was in charge of. It was the glue of hope that held the place together. You couldn't just tell people they had no chance. The only thing to do was find somebody still alive out there. Find them with a radio, which would mean they had power and therefore light, before he said another word to anyone. And if he found nothing, if the world really was empty, then what would happen anyway. It was better if nobody knew. He got to work that morning. In the shed, piled among the old CRTs and CPUs and plasmas and bins of cell phones and Blu-rays, was an old stereo receiver. Just AM and FM bands, but he could open that up. And an oscilloscope. A copper wire up the chimney served as their antenna. Michael refitted the guts of the receiver into a plain CPU chassis to camouflage it. The only person who might have noticed an extra CPU sitting on the counter would be Gabe, and from what Sarah had told him, the poor guy wasn't ever coming back, and jacked the receiver into the panel using the audio port. The battery control system had a simple media program, and with a little work he was able to configure the equalizer to filter out the battery noise. They wouldn't be able to broadcast. He had no transmitter and would have to figure out how to build one from the bottom up. But for the time being, with a little patience, he'd be able to scoop out any decent signal from the west. They found nothing. Oh, there was plenty to hear out there. A surprising range of activity, from ULF to microwaves. The odd cell phone tower powered by a working solar panel. Geothermals still pushing juice back into the grid. Even a couple of satellites still in their orbits, dutifully transmitting their cosmic hellos and probably wondering where everybody on planet Earth had run off to. A whole hidden world of electronic noise. And nobody, not a single person, home. Day by day, Elton would sit at the radio, the headphones clamped to his ears, his sightless eyes turned upward in their sockets. Michael would isolate a signal, clear out the noise, and send it to the amplifier, where it would be filtered a second time and pushed through the phones. After a moment of intense concentration, Elton would nod, maybe take a moment to give his crummy beard a thoughtful rub, and then proclaim in his gentle voice, something faint, irregular. Maybe an old distress beacon. Or a ground signal. A mine, maybe. Or with a tight shake of the head, nothing here, let's move on. So they sat through the days and nights, Michael at the CRT, Elton with the earphones clamped to the sides of his head, his mind seemingly adrift in the leftover signals of their all but vanished species. Whenever they found one, Michael would record it in the logbook, noting the time and frequency and anything else about it. Then they'd do it all again.
Elton had been born blind, so Michael didn't really feel sorry for him, not on that score. Elton's being blind was just a part of who he was. It was the radiation that had done it. Elton's parents were walkers, part of the second wave to come in 50-odd years ago, when the settlements in Baja had been overrun. The survivors had walked straight through the irradiated ruins that had once been San Diego, and by the time the group arrived, 28 souls, those who could still stand, were carrying the others. Elton's mother was pregnant, delirious with fever. She delivered just before she died. His father could have been anyone. No one even learned their names. And for the most part, Elton got along fine. He had a cane he used when he left the lighthouse, which wasn't all that often, and he seemed content to spend his days at the panel, making use of himself in the only way he knew how. Apart from Michael, he knew more about the batteries than anyone. A miraculous feat, considering the fact that he'd never actually seen them. But according to Elton, this gave him an advantage, because he wasn't fooled by what things merely appeared to be. "Those batteries are like a woman, Michael," he liked to say. "You've got to learn to listen." Now, on the evening of the 54th of summer, first evening bell about to sound, 4 nights since a viral had been killed in the nets by the watcher Arlo Wilson, Michael called up the battery monitors, a line of bars for each of the 6 cells. 54% on 2 and 3, a whisper under 50 on 5 and 4, a flat 50 on 1 and 6. Temperature on all of them in the green, 31 degrees. Down the mountain, the winds were blowing at a steady 13 kph with gusts to 20. He ran through the checklist, charging the capacitors, testing all the relays. What had Alicia said? "You push the button, they come on?" That's how little people understood. "You should double-check the second cell," Elton said from his chair. He was spooning curds of sheep's cheese from a cup into his mouth. "There's nothing wrong with the second cell." "Just do it," he said. "Trust me." Michael sighed and called the battery monitors back up on the screen. Sure enough, the charge on number 2 was dropping. 53%. 52. The temperature was nudging up as well. He would have asked Elton how he'd known, but his answer was always the same. An enigmatic cock of the head, as if to say, "I could hear it, Michael." "Open the relay," Elton advised. "Do it again and see if it settles down." Second evening bell was moments away. Well, they could run on the other 5 cells if they had to, then figure out what the problem was. Michael opened the relay, waited a moment to vent any gas in the line, and closed it again. The meter stayed flat at 55. "Static is all," said Elton as second bell began to ring. He gave his spoon a little wave. "That relay is a bit squirrely, though. We should swap it out." The door of the lighthouse opened then. Elton lifted his face. "That you, Sarah?" Michael's sister stepped inside, still dressed to ride and covered in dust. "Evening, Elton." "Now what's that I smell on you?" He was smiling from ear to ear. "Mountain lilac?" She pushed a strand of sweat-dampened hair from behind an ear. "I smell like sheep, Elton, but thanks." She directed her words to Michael. "Are you coming home tonight? I thought I'd cook." Michael thought he should probably stay where he was, with one of the cells acting up. Night was also the best time for the radio. But he hadn't eaten all day, and at the thought of warm food, his stomach let loose an empty rumble. "You mind, Elton?" The old man shrugged. "I know where to find you if I need you. You go now if you like." "You want me to bring you something?" Sarah offered as Michael was rising from his chair. "We've got plenty." But Elton shook his head as he always did. "Not tonight, thanks." He took the earphones from their place on the counter and held them up. "I've got the whole wide world for company." Michael and his sister stepped out into the lights. After so many hours in the dim hut, Michael had to pause on the step and blink the glare away. They moved down the path past the storage sheds, toward the pens. The air was rich with the organic funk of animals. He could hear the bleating of the herd and, as they walked, the nickering of horses from the stables. Continuing onto the narrow path that edged the field, underneath the south wall, Michael could see the runners moving back and forth along the catwalks, their shapes silhouetted against the spots. Michael saw Sarah watching also, her eyes distant and preoccupied, shining with reflected light.
"Don't worry," Michael said. "He'll be fine."
His sister didn't respond. He wondered if she'd heard him. They said nothing more until they reached the house. At the kitchen pump, Sarah washed up while Michael lit the candles. She stepped out onto the back porch and returned a moment later, swinging a good-sized jackrabbit by the ears.
"Flyers," Michael said. "Where'd you get him?"
Sarah's mood had lifted. Her face wore a proud smile. Michael could see the wound where Sarah's arrow had skewered the animal through the throat.
"Upperfield, just above the pits. I was riding along, and there he was, right out in the open."
How long had it been since Michael had eaten rabbit? Since anyone had even seen a rabbit? Most of the wildlife was long gone, except for the squirrels, which seemed to multiply even faster than the virals could kill them off, and the smaller birds, the sparrows and wrens, which they either didn't want or couldn't catch.
"You want to clean him?" Sarah asked.
"I'm not even sure I'd remember how," Michael confessed. Sarah made a face of exasperation and drew her blade from her belt.
"Fine. Make yourself useful and set the fire."
They made the rabbit into a stew, with carrots and potatoes from the bin in the cellar and cornmeal to thicken the sauce. Sarah claimed to remember their father's recipe, but Michael could tell she was guessing. It didn't matter. Soon the savory aroma of cooking meat was bubbling from the kitchen hearth, filling the whole house with a cozy warmth that Michael hadn't felt in a long time. Sarah had taken the empty skin out to the yard to scrape it while Michael tended the stove, waiting for her return. He had bowls and spoons set when she stepped back inside, wiping her hands on a rag.
"You know, I know you're not going to listen to me, but you and Elton should be careful."
Sarah knew all about the radio. The way she came in and out of the lighthouse, it had been impossible to avoid this. But he had kept the rest from her.
"It's just a receiver, Sarah. We're not even transmitting. What all do you listen to out there anyway?"
Sitting at the table, he offered a shrug, hoping to kill the conversation as fast as possible. What was there to say? He was looking for the army. But the army was dead. Everyone was dead. And the lights were going out.
"Just noise, mostly."
She was looking at him closely, her hands on her hips as she stood with her back to the sink, waiting him out. When Michael said nothing more, she sighed and shook her head.
"Well, don't get caught," his sister said.
They ate without speaking at the table in the kitchen. The meat was a little stringy, but so delicious Michael could barely stop himself from moaning as he chewed. Usually he didn't go to bed until after dawn, but he could have lain down right there at the table, his head cradled in his folded arms, and fallen instantly asleep. There was something familiar as well. Not just familiar, but also a little sad about eating Jack stew at the table. Just the two of them. He lifted his eyes to find Sarah's looking back at him.
"I know," she said. "I miss them too."
He wanted to tell her then. About the batteries, and the logbook, and their father, and what he'd known. Just to have one other person carry this knowledge. But this was a selfish wish, Michael knew. Nothing he could actually allow himself to do. Sarah pushed back from the table and carried their dishes to the pump. When she was finished washing up, she filled an earthenware pot with the leftover stew and wrapped it with a piece of heavy cloth to keep it warm. "You taking that to Walt?" Michael asked. Walter was their father's older brother. As the storekeeper, he was in charge of share, a member of the Board of Trade, and household too, the oldest living fisher, a three-legged stool of responsibilities that made him one of the most powerful citizens of the colony, second only to Sue Ramirez and Sanjay Patel. But he was also a widower who lived alone. His wife Jean had been killed on Dark Night, and he liked the shine too much and often neglected to eat. When Walt wasn't in the storehouse, he could usually be found fussing with the still he kept in the shed behind his house, or else passed out somewhere inside. Sarah shook her head. I don't think I could face Walt right now. I'm taking it to Elton. Michael watched her face. He knew she was thinking of Peter again. You should get some rest. I'm sure they're okay. They're late. Just a day? It's routine. His sister said nothing. It was terrible, Michael thought, what love could do to a person. He couldn't see the sense in it. Look, Leash is riding with them. I'm sure they're safe. Sarah scowled, looking away. It's Leash I'm worried about. She headed first to the sanctuary, as she often did when sleep eluded her. Something about seeing the children tucked in their beds. She didn't know if it made her feel better or worse, but it made her feel something, besides the hollow ache of worry. She liked to recall her own days there as a little, when the world seemed like a safe place, even a happy place, and all there was to concern her was when her parents would come to visit, or if teacher was in a good mood that day or not, and who was friends with whom. For the most part, it hadn't seemed odd that she and her brother lived in the sanctuary and their parents somewhere else. She'd never known a different existence, and at night when her mother or father or the two of them together came to say good night to her and Michael, she never thought to ask them where they went when the visit was over. We have to go now, they'd say, when teacher announced it was time. And that one word, go, became the whole of the situation in Sarah's mind, and probably Michael's too. Parents came and stayed for a bit, and then they had to go. Many of her best memories of her parents came from those brief bedtime visits when they would read her and Michael a story, or just tuck them into their cots. And then one night she'd ruined it, quite by accident. Where do you sleep? She asked her mother as she was preparing to depart. If you don't sleep here, with us, where do you go? And when Sarah asked this, something seemed to fall behind her mother's eyes, like a shade being quickly drawn down a window. Oh, her mother said, gathering her expression into a smile that Sarah detected as false. I don't sleep, not really. Sleep is something for you, little Sarah, and for your brother Michael. And the look on her mother's face as she said these words was the first time, Sarah now believed, that she'd glimpsed the terrible truth. It was true, what everyone said. You hated teacher for telling you. How Sarah had loved teacher until that day. As much as she loved her own parents, maybe even more. Her 8th birthday. She knew something would happen. Something wonderful, that the children who turned 8 went someplace special, but nothing more specific than that. The ones who returned, to visit a younger sibling or to have littles of their own, were older, so much time having passed that they had become different people entirely, and where they'd been and what they'd done was a secret you couldn't know. It was precisely because it was a secret that it was so special, this new place that awaited outside the walls of the sanctuary. Anticipation gathered inside her as her birthday approached. So keen was her excitement that never did it occur to her to wonder what would happen to Michael without her. His own day would come. You were warned by teacher never to talk about this, but of course the littles did when teacher wasn't around. in the washroom or dining hall or at night in the big room, whispers passing up and down the lines of cots. The talk was always of release and who was next in line. What was the world like outside the sanctuary? Did people live in castles like the people in books? What animals would they find, and could they speak? The caged mice teacher kept in the classroom were, to a one, discouragingly silent. What wonderful foods were there to eat? What wonderful toys to play with? Never had Sarah been so excited, waiting for this glorious day when she would step into the world. She awoke on the morning of her birthday feeling as if she were floating on a cloud of happiness. And yet somehow she would have to contain this joy until rest time. Only then, when the littles were asleep, would teacher take her to the special place. Though no one said as much, all through morning meal and circle time she could tell that everyone was delighted for her, except for Michael, who did nothing to hide his envy, grumpily refusing to speak with her. Well, that was Michael. If he couldn't be happy for her, she wasn't going to let it spoil her special day. It wasn't until after lunch, when teacher called everyone around to say goodbye, that she began to wonder if maybe he knew something she didn't. "What is it, Michael?" asked teacher. "Can't you say goodbye to your sister? Can't you be happy for her?" And Michael looked at her and said, "It's not what you think, Sarah." Then hugged her quickly and ran from the room before she could say a word. Well, that was strange, she'd thought at the time, and still did, even now, all these years gone by. How had Michael known? Much later, when the two of them were alone again, she'd remembered this scene and asked him about it. "How did you know?" But Michael could only shake his head. "I just did," he said. "Not the details, but the kind of thing it was. The way they spoke to us, Mom and Dad, at night, tucking us in. You could see it in their eyes." But back then, the afternoon of her release, with Michael darting away and teacher taking her hand, she hadn't wondered for long. Just chalked it up to Michael being Michael. The final goodbyes, the embraces, the feeling of the moment arriving. Peter was there, and Mouse Patal, and Ben Chow, and Galen Strauss, and Wendy Ramirez, and all the rest, touching her, saying her name. "Remember us," everyone said. She was holding the bag that contained her things, her clothing and slippers, and the little rag doll that she'd had since she was small. You were allowed to take one toy. And teacher took her by the hand and led her out from the big room into the little courtyard ringed by windows where the children played when the sun was high in the sky, with the swings and the seesaw and the piles of old tires to climb, and through another door into a room she'd never seen before. Like a classroom, but empty, the shelves barren, no pictures on the walls.